I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. It's Friday, which means we're tapping into community newspapers and alternative presses for a look at the stories that went under the radar this week. Here with me in Studio 3 are Gin Dumchus of the Dorchester Reporter, Peter Katsis of the Boston Phoenix, and Sue O'Connell representing South End News and the Bay Windows. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks,
hey,
Callie.
Great to be here.
So we got to jump right off Peter Katsis with Senator Buzzkill, that's what you're calling him, a Quincy legislator.
Senator John F. Keenan.
Yeah. Tell us all about him.
He is trying to thwart the will of the people and subvert the medical marijuana bill. Thwart the referendum, which would make medical marijuana legal, which has made medical marijuana legal in
as
the
of January
state.
1st.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And which would also allow people to be growing their own right now for medical purposes only. And actually, I have a sarcastic tone in my voice. I shouldn't, because I mean that seriously. But he's introducing a 21-page bill that basically got the intent here and make it very difficult to use. Now, the idea isn't all is crazy as it sounds. I think it's a bad idea because the people voted for this, and you know it really is a will of the people thing. But an unlikely ally has emerged in Amherst Senator Stanley Rosenberg, who feels somewhat betrayed by the pro-pot people because he thinks the referendum was written in a way that would, you know, that it's almost creating a backdoor for the ultimate legalization of marijuana. You know what? He has a good point. But the fact is that our laws in Massachusetts and in the United States, as they pertain to marijuana, are so crazy that, you know, no one abides by them. I mean, you know, let me correct that. If you want to smoke pot, you can smoke pot.
Right. Well, we're talking about, let's just be clear that there's a difference between recreational use and medical marijuana,
right,
which is really what our referendum did here in Massachusetts.
Right. Now,
focused on that.
If this were an effort to establish, you know, quality control, there's a big question. Okay, just because you smoke or ingest marijuana, if you have glaucoma or cancer or HIV and you need
or ALS,
or, mm-hmm. ALS or, mm-hmm. or any of the things that it has proven therapeutic properties for, you know, how strong should it be? How weak should it be? What's the purity? If this were an attempt to try to truly make it more medical rather than more restrictive, I would say more power to the guy. But this is going in the wrong direction.
Well, I want to just put on the table, we've been doing a lot of stories about medical marijuana, and we should note that there is a meeting coming up next week, again, as the folks in the state are trying to put together the regulations. So what the Quincy legislator is doing is trying to move in the absence of those regulations. They will be in place in May 1st. But I think it makes a lot of people, nervous that in between this time, it's kind of a free-for-all because the referendum does allow folk who need it to grow their own, a 60-day supply, which equals 12 plants approximately. We just had the Department of Public Health Commissioner here yesterday, Barbara Ferrer, talking about this planning and how carefully they're going over this. So on the one hand, it could be argued, Sue, because I know you're anxious to get in this conversation, that some of what he's trying to put in this bill is about to be addressed in the regulations that are coming.
I agree. I don't disagree at all with that. I think the bigger picture, too, is that laws pass all the time that we don't have things ready for when the law passes. Mm-hmm. You know, we have laws that pass that have no funding mandate. So laws get passed and there's no way to fund the changes. There are laws that are passed that actually overrule some law that's already existing on the book that was meant to do the same thing. You know, we have all these arcane, vague law writers, and we need to have some facility or some action or some oversight that says, okay, this has passed or this is going to pass. We've written it. What do we need to do to make it happen logically? Yeah. And that's sort of the bigger issue. It's
having
not just about marijuana.
Do this is like having
right.
the head of the NRA in charge of Biden's gun control task
right.
force.
But you know, but listen, the point of this under the radar piece is that this other guy, Amherst Senator Stanley Rosenberg, was all in favor of this
right.
referendum. He was a backer again, and now he's saying, hey, maybe Quincy Senator John F. Kennan has a point.
And I think he's also reflecting the feeling of some members of the legislature. I remember talking to some members of the Dorchester delegation back when this was still being waged as a ballot question. And they were really afraid that if this law was put into place, the Department of Public Health, which has had some issues, might have problems implementing it. And they just didn't want they just wanted some rules in place. And they felt the law was the one that was put on the ballot wasn't written as well as they would have wanted it. So I think what Kennan is doing is kind of tapping into that, despite being opposed to the ballot initiative in the first place.
But this, you know, this marijuana, medical marijuana change has been a lot like civil unions and same-sex marriage.
I was just going to say that.
You know, it has more in common with that than with anything else. And this is sort of the civil unions idea that, you know, mm-hmm. you'll have medical marijuana. But at the same time, unlike same-sex marriage, which across every state has gone back and forth between a judicial decision, a let-the-people-vote decision, or representatives at the states making laws, I think this is something you're not going to put back. I think that a number of people, and I would say out loud that, yes, it is a step towards recreational use. I have heard more people who I know have smoked recreationally who are now saying that they smoke recreationally. Mm. They're not in the closet about it, if you will. I hear over and over, and I'm not just like, you know, hanging out in the corner with fun folks at Harvard Square. I'm, you know, talking about suburbanites who are now saying things like, well, I'd rather have my alcoholic uncle, you know, smoke a joint than drink a pint of beer, you know, and get drunk. So the discussion has changed immediately as soon as this law passed. You can, you know, I agree that if I were a lawmaker who thought this was narrowly written and then it turned out it wasn't, I might be upset. But at the same time, I think the genie's out.
Well, but again, okay, you've been talking to folks. Why wouldn't they wait, or why wouldn't he wait until after the regulations come out? Then you can see where the gaps are, if in fact that's his concern. And it would seem to me there would be even more allies, if you will, and maybe some surprising ones, as he's already found with Amherst Senator Stanley Rosenberg. But maybe not, because the committee has been working very, very carefully, looking at models all across the country so that they don't make the mistakes that happen in California particularly, and that what happens in Massachusetts is really custom fitted for us.
Right. I think he's trying to get out in front. I mean, like, you know, like Barney Frank raising the prospect of being interim senator. He's saying, you know what, if I put this out here first, maybe that means I'll have leverage and I'll be able to have more of my ideas put into the final regulations.
It's a smart political move, mm-hmm. what he's doing. Nevertheless, at the root of this is Beacon Hill's fear of people, the voice of the people. Mm. The people voted. Beacon Hill is worried about that.
And the people voted overwhelmingly
yeah.
in this case.
Yes.
This wasn't even a close thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, this will be right before us for a while. And again, a meeting next Wednesday with all concerned who are working on those regulations that have to be in place by May the 1st. So since you brought up the whole civil unions, gay marriage mm-hmm. thing, Sue O'Connell, let's go right to piece you're talking
Which
about.
Which state do you want to go to?
Rhode Island. Rhode
little
Island.
Rhodey. Poor little Rhodey. Yeah. The only state in New England that does not have same-sex marriage rights, marriage equality. They do have civil unions, but no one cares about them. No one is entering into the civil union. And it's been perplexing because Rhode Island has been a overwhelmingly gay supportive state. David Cicilline is now a member of Congress. He's openly gay. He was the mayor of Providence. They have a very active gay and lesbian nightlife scene. Like, you know, whenever we go there, we feel like we're on leave from the fleet. You know, it's like crazy fun party town. But at the same time, they have not been able to go forward with same-sex marriage. Of course, like many towns like this, they also have a very conservative religious group, mostly in Roman Catholics, but who have over the past few years been becoming more accepting of same-sex marriage rights. They openly also have an openly gay leader of the House, Gordon Fox, who has been reluctant, as sometimes openly gay people are, to kind of push the issue forward. But it now seems like Rhode Island's time has come. There's a couple of bills that have been pushed forward, hoping to get same-sex marriage legalized in Rhode Island. You can, I forget if it's the divorce, you can get a divorce in Rhode Island, I think, if you got married in another state. Mm-hmm. So you can get divorced there. And it's basically the last election gave a number of pro-LGBT rights folks, moved them into office. So it's time for little Rhodey to come to the marriage party, basically.
But do you think, because apparently there's some resistance in the Senate, I guess that's where the holdup is.
Yeah, I think it's a politics issue. You know, I think that there'll be some horse trading that happens. I'm not that acquainted with all of the players in Rhode Island, but I think it's now become an issue of state pride. You know, that if you're surrounded by states that allow this, and you have some entertainment places like the Rosecliff Mansions and Westport and Newport and some areas where you might want to get some marriage money, this would be the time to do it.
Yeah, then that was one of the things that I thought was interesting, again, you might want to respond to, is that one, Lincoln Chafee really just went right there and said, listen, this is an economic thing. By our having this stance on the civil unions as opposed to marriage and being surrounded by other states that have a different position, that have marriage available, we're losing out. And we cannot afford to do that in Rhode Island. Look at our bottom line. And that seems to be a powerful argument.
And that was a very similar argument to Massachusetts as well. It's just, you know, here's economic gains that the state could pick up. And I think, you know, Rhode Island also has Massachusetts as an example. I think during the debate there was talk of, like, you know, was it Massachusetts turning into a mecca?
Las Vegas of gay weddings.
Exactly. You know, and here we are several years later, and you know, everything is fine.
Yeah, the sun still comes up.
Yeah, the sun still comes up. So I think for Rhode Island, that's a very powerful argument that you know.
It is, but I got to say, as executive editor of the second largest statewide newspaper in Rhode Island, the Providence Phoenix, the idea of local pride is just doesn't exist there.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a case where, once again, as I was saying about Beacon Hill and the will of the people, you know, the state Senate is willing to buck what is now a majority opinion. Maybe Sue's right. I'm more skeptical. I think what will happen is it will pass the House, but it won't pass the Senate. It's going to happen eventually. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. Rhode Island has a large gay population. Yeah. I mean, this is not like New Hampshire, for example. Mm-hmm. It's a very active community, and I think the lack of progress on this issue has really politicized a lot of people who before didn't care. And many of the and I'll call them kids, there are a bunch of 20-somethings who are really working on this issue. So I think that's probably why I'm a little bit more optimistic, because it's sort of an old-fashioned, you know, you got the nightclubs down there, you've got folks, straight folks and gay folks going to this great drag show at this great, you know, local Italian restaurant all the time, and you have a lot of young people who are demanding it. So it's an old-fashioned mix of political action.
Well, it's also, Rhode Island is an essentially decent state. Mm-hmm. Rhode Island is a very live and let live. It's a sort of different libertarian feel than in Maine, which is sort of Yankee. Down there, and it's a big Italian state, Portuguese, it's a more Mediterranean live and let live ethic there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've lived in Rhode Island myself, and it's contrary to the state's DNA to oppose it. That's why it'll pass.
Their gay pride parade happens at night, and it goes right down the center of town, and we at Bay Windows participated in it. And it's obviously smaller than Boston Pride, but the numbers of families, this is years ago, like, you know, 8 years ago, that were out to see the parade, it was just, like Peter said, a totally Mediterranean feel, that it wasn't a big deal that this was happening. Let's take the kids to go see the drag queens on the floats. So It's an interesting little experiment, which we hope goes the way to same-sex marriage rights.
All right. Well, this has been going around for a while, so I'll be interested to see how this works itself out. I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio, and I am here with Peter Katsas, executive editor of The Phoenix, Sue O'Connell, you just heard her, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News, and Gin Dumptious, news editor at The Dorchester Reporter. And we are talking local news that went under the radar. And Gin, it's your time to talk about Governor Patrick's state work diversity bill, which is so under the radar, I knew nothing about it until you wrote about it.
Well, it was Senator Sonia Chang Diaz was pushing it in the Senate. This, I believe, it was actually filed in this past session that just ended, and one of those rare bills that ended up getting to the governor's desk in a rather on Beacon Hill standards, a short manner. So basically, what the bill does is the state will publish statistics in terms of workforce diversity on publicly funded contracts as a way to see how contractors are doing. Are they employing local residents, people of color, women, just so the community can see, are they living up to the contracts? And it's a bill that I think, especially in Boston, has been a big deal. Boston has something called the Boston Resident Jobs Policy, and it's been in place. They're guidelines; they're not requirements.
I think we have to emphasize that because people look at this and you think, well, isn't this already in place? And you don't realize that what you just referred to are really guidelines and not part of a law.
Right. It's a big misconception. And I think it's a big frustration for folks. And we've been hearing for the last couple of years regularly, people call in and say, listen, I just drove by this construction site and I saw New Hampshire plates on the construction truck, or, you know, I saw people working in the pit and there was nobody there from the neighborhood. So it's a frustration for folks. And what Boston has done with the help of Councillor Presley and Mike Ross is they've on a more regular basis started putting those statistics online and available so you can dig through. And what Senator Chang Diaz has done and other folks, Rep. Forey, is that they've put together that bill that says, okay, well, the state has to do it on a quarterly basis as well. And what Senator Chang Diaz has said is that, well, because the state can't constantly be looking at these numbers, this is a great opportunity for some crowdsourcing, for some citizen watchdogs and newspapers as well, to really look and drill down into these numbers and hold these folks accountable. If they're saying they're hiring people from the neighborhood and people of color, then let's hold them accountable for it.
You know, it's an issue that comes up publicly every mayoral race and every at-large council race in Boston, because, as Ken said, it's very simple to drive through a neighborhood that is mostly X and look in the pit and see no X, you know, whatever X happens to be. Mm-hmm. And we do have these guidelines, but we just don't have the enforcement for it. So this is actually a great tool for, you know, the person in your neighborhood who's actually paying attention to those things. And the thing that really burns everyone is the out-of-state plates. You know, you've got these construction workers or foremen parking in your neighborhood, and that's all fine and good, and you've got this displacement of what happens when construction comes, and then you see the out-of-state plates, and it's really like, why aren't these jobs going to Massachusetts residents or South End residents? And it's a great tool.
Also, imagine other municipalities like Lawrence and Lowell or Springfield or Worcester. In Boston, however shaky things may be, there is a movement to force some sort of compliance here. But imagine in other municipalities, it is a statewide problem that's largely an urban problem, too. And this is good legislation because what it does is it makes information available to everyone so that if you see something that ticks you off, it will hopefully motivate you to squawk.
And it keeps you focused, too, because if you think something, then you can go look it up and see that it's different than what you think, so you can move on to the next issue. Sometimes with folks at meetings, they have some information, anecdotal information. They're right on the big picture, but they have the wrong facts, and this actually would allow them to be factually correct.
Well, the other thing, too, is it encourages a community engagement. I wonder if the site will accept photos, because I can see people, no, I'm serious,
no,
people
know,
driving by saying, I don't care what they they told you. Listen, do you see this plate? This is where it is. Or do you see the fact? Because you've quoted again in your piece the representative from the women's tradesmen and saying, hey, this is a good way for us to check and see how many women are on these projects, and they're not been getting their fair share.
Right, live fact checking.
Yeah.
And I think there's also frustration of getting, you know, Senator Chang Diaz told me, you know, I've had trouble getting these numbers, and I'm a state senator. You know, she's had to ask 6 or 7 times. So to really smooth the path on that is important. And you know, being able to drive by, take pictures, and send them to Beacon Hill and say, listen, you know, I don't think they're living up to what the contract says. You know, that's a big deal for folks.
Yeah.
Quick question: is there any penalty? For example, failure to comply would mean you'd be barred from public contracts.
That's a good question. I didn't see that. That'd be a question for Senator Chang Diaz.
But one of the things that would happen is that when these developers come in front of the city boards or the town, the community organizations,
exactly, there would be a record.
There's a record that they didn't comply, and that alone would be more difficult than an actual sanction.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, moving on. Sue, you have a great piece in Bay Windows about Bishop Gene Robinson. Mm-hmm. He stepped down last week. Well, this week, I guess.
Yeah,
last week.
Yeah. Yeah, Gene Robinson, who was the first openly gay Episcopal bishop. And, you know, he stepped down early. He was able to stay on longer before retirement. But there's now another openly gay bishop, a woman who's there. So he doesn't feel like he's the only one and has to carry the torch. And he's taken some time. He's a great guy. You know, he's just really, he says in the piece that he's a, you know, an over the top extrovert. And he really is. But he also remembers who you are, which is helpful. And he really thinks that he can serve the greater good by being able to be out and see people. But it is stunning the amount of, you know, you hear these things in the abstract about how he was snubbed and how people sent him death threats. But to actually talk with him about the human result of that is a little bit heartbreaking. It's not a little bit. It's heartbreaking to hear that, you know, part of the reason that he and his partner became officially married, even though the date that they picked was in conflict with something and people thought with the Episcopalian Church, and they thought that he was you know, basically giving them the business. Thank you, the backhand.
Yeah.
You know, he did it because of all the death threats that he was getting, and he wanted his partner to be protected if something happened. And also just, you know, being an official representative of your organization and traveling to Great Britain to meet another and being snubbed and not being able to be seen simply because you were openly gay. And it seems like 100 years ago right now that this was all in the mix. And we're reminded that, you know, the Anglican community does have a sort of democratic process, if you will, and they went through this when women were able to be ordained, and they went through this when African Americans were able to be ordained, and they do come out of it on the other side. But there was a lot of ugliness at the beginning of his tenure, and you know, it's great to see him coming out on the other end in a different world than the one when he came out as openly gay.
If people haven't seen him, first of all, we've had him on the show a few times, and he is absolutely an extrovert and really thoughtful and really pulls together his faith in a way that's, you know, kind of stunning. It stops you because he's, as you can imagine a bishop would be, you know, very deeply rooted in his faith. But you can see all that. And also in a documentary called Love Free or Die by Mackie Alston, which really shows you the progression of change of attitude about it at the height of the death threats to some other kinds of reactions to him. It's really very interesting. Have you ever had a chance to interact with Bishop Gene Robinson, Peter?
Oh, yeah. I have met him. And although born a Catholic, I go to the Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, his reputation is sterling. No, it was a very, very interesting story. And it is interesting, as Sue was saying, how I remember when the news first came about. And it's almost at the so what level now. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that it happened in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. But in a way, not. Again,
a live free or die state.
It is a live free or die state. And it's also a state where people know their neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where you know who you're voting for. You know who you're leading. And no, it was just he is a very charismatic guy.
Again, did you ever have an interaction with him?
But he sounds like an interesting guy. I mean, speaking as an introvert, I mean, that's, you know, my hat's off to him.
Well, he's going to be doing some part-time work, if you will, church work. I mean,
he's not stepping away from the faith. No, it's just, you know, I just think he has he has a greater opportunity. He's not bound to, you know, the job of being a bishop, but he's still going to be an Episcopalian.
Which is great. All right, we're going over the week's local news that went under the radar with Peter Katsas of the Phoenix, Gin Dumptious of the Dorchester Reporter, and Sue O'Connell representing the South End and Bay Windows. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. We're going over the local stories that went under the radar this week with Peter Katsas of the Phoenix, Gin Dumptious of the Dorchester Reporter, and Sue O'Connell of Bay Windows and the South End News. Gin, we were just talking about Bishop Gene Robinson retiring, feeling that he can now, different time and place in New Hampshire. And you got a piece about Menino titled Feisty Menino Still Unclear on Reelection Plan. That would be Mayor Tom Menino. And you're really talking about his being out in public a lot now and doing work and preparing for his State of the City address.
Yeah, so he's kind of trying to get back into the swing of things. You know, he was I caught him as he was leaving the office last week, and he said, you know, I'm back in action, and his spokeswoman said, well, okay, part time. So he's been holding press conferences. He's been talking about the flu. He's been talking about Converse moving into the city. And while he's moving slower than I think we've seen him in the last couple of years, he seems like he's definitely trying to get back into the swing of things. He says he's ahead of schedule on physical therapy, and he's aiming obviously for January 29th. That's when his state of the city is at Faneuil Hall. So obviously all the reporters and political operatives are watching it very closely because, you know, and everybody wants to know, is there going to be a full-blown mayor's race this year, or is it going to be largely status quo?
I thought you made much of, which I think is probably important because people are wondering, that he says he will stand during his State of the City address, which is, you know, a good indication, evidence that, you know, I'm back.
Yeah,
you know?
He's had issues, you know, back issues before, and I think he had a foot or leg issue, two knee surgery. Yeah. So, you know, it's not uncommon to see him with a cane or leaning or sitting. He's sat on stage a number of times, but, you know, Mayor Menino at 25% power is still way ahead of us. You know, I mean, whatever you think of his politics or how he, you know, the man is working.
And what do you think, Peter?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I've heard from people in City Hall, even before he moved into the Parkman House, he has been, you know, calling people two or three levels down than he would normally deal with. It's, hey, what about this? Right. Or, hey, how about that? I mean, it's clearly a device to spread the word of mouth that, hey, look, he's back.
I'm watching you.
But
I
would not underestimate Menino's just sheer pigheadedness and determination to, A, get better, and, B, run again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my money's on him, you know, running again, whether he'll be reelected. We'll see. But there's no one that's going to convince me otherwise. I'll tell you this, though. I think Menino's State of the City address is going to be not since Ted Kennedy debated Mitt Romney years ago when all eyes were on Faneuil Hall. I think that this in a slightly lesser but just as important way is everyone is going to be. And Menino knows this and his troops know it. And my guess is he'll do pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting, Gin, is that all of the people that you note in your piece that who are some of whom have not been supporters of him are reluctant to say, well, maybe it's okay if he doesn't run. Nobody wants to say that. Nobody wants to be out there on that line.
Right. You get your head blasted off if that happens. You know, obviously on the record, everybody says, oh, absolutely, he should run again. I think privately in terms of, you know, folks I talk to in the neighborhoods, you know, I think there is a feeling of folks of like, well, you know, we do have a stable of candidates that is able to run if he chooses to call it a fifth of the end of his tenure,
the end of a quarter centuries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Trying to count up how many years it was.
Well, it was interesting. At one press conference, I think it was on Friday, he was swearing in a school committee member, and you know, he had gotten the question, you know, are you going to run again? When are you going to announce? And this is something that pops up, I think, pretty much at every single press conference now. And he said, you know, my announcement, whether I'm running again, is not going to be the most important thing I do this year. It's going to be job creation, and it's going to be I think school assignment is mm-hmm. is the other thing he said, school assignment reform, which I thought was an interesting response.
It's an interesting response, yeah. But come on. This is like
Boston. Cynic Peter.
Boston is like Cuba. No one can imagine it without Castro.
Right, right.
No one can imagine Boston
you know,
without
Menino. I'm just anxious for the day when he doesn't run, where we can write the stories of all the things he said off the record. I mean, that, you know, how, you know, at the openings of things when he's mad at a city councilor, what he says to the city councilor. I mean, that's going to be a blast.
Well, I'll buy that paper, that's for sure. All right. Well, back to our other leading political figure, Governor Patrick. You got an interesting piece in the Phoenix about this new plan to look at the budget, or to design the budget so that it's program oriented. And that's a really – is this something that other people are doing? First explain it. I had not heard this before.
It is. Well, yeah. It signals the fact that Governor Patrick is beginning to look for work in the private sector. So he is
– Send the emails to Peter
so
Katsas.
He is moving, I think, quite reasonably, and it's a very good thing to do, to attempt to depoliticize the budgeting process. Basically, what we're talking about here is the executive is requiring all departments to justify what they're asking for. It's not quite zero-based budgeting, but it's a step in that direction. And for people who don't know what zero-based budgeting is, it means like, okay, you begin the year, your budget is zero. Now ask for each set of money or monies you need and explain why you need it. I think this and by the way, I was being a wise guy, but I meant it, about this is a good move for someone who'll be heading into the private sector. Mm. But it also bespeaks the fact that the state doesn't have as much money as it used to have. Look, it's no mistake that in Washington we've had this tremendous battle over the so-called fiscal cliff, and now we're talking about coining a trillion-dollar platinum coin to get around budget restrictions. Massachusetts is in the same boat, and it's even worse because, unlike Washington, we can't print our own money. And the governor is very professionally going about this in trying to bring some rhyme or reason to the budgeting process. I, of course, believe it'll be defeat, you know, that
really?
They'll begin with they'll begin with rhyme or reason.
Oh.
But I have total faith in the legislature's ability to mess up any attempt to bring sound business practices to play in state finance.
But. Well, what I thought was interesting about the way that this would work is that, because you have a quote in here, it says, in theory, it would show all the different pots of money and how they connect and work together. So if you're doing it programmatically, I mean, even I could figure out
makes
what's
sense,
going on
it?
There.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. Just take public higher education. There are the universities have trust funds, money that people have left there. There's more money on the table, so to speak, than people may recognize. And money's going to be short in looking for ways to connect the dots. I mean, look, transportation, the state is going to be in just we've got roads that are falling apart, bridges that are falling down. We can't really sufficiently pay for the MBTA.
Just heard that we're really disgusted with the South right. Koreans and the four
the
new coaches they were supposed
coaches,
to for
yeah.
the commuter
yep.
commuter rail. They're now we're saying forget it. We've been waiting forever, and you guys can't get it together.
You know, well, I wonder if money wasn't tight. If we,
if we would have broken the contract or
yeah.
tried to break the contract. Mm-hmm. I mean, Peter's joking about it not going forward. But what happens now is that all of the constituency groups who have funding, who have been able to protect funding, now have to go fight for the funding, and it's not all...
Now, give me an example.
AIDS Action Committee,
right, okay.
The Gay and Lesbian Friends of the Youth that have a budget line, Safe School. I mean, everybody in the budget now who should be in the budget and should have the money that they get, now has to make a case on why they need it. Mm-hmm. So there will be some, you know, wheeling and dealing, which should happen. It's just hard to look at it like, well, of course they should have to demand and say that or prove why they need the money. It's so, but I'd like to start the year that way every year. Mm. You know, I think it would be a great exercise, but it does put everyone on alert.
Well, again, one of the things that I think that this might do, but since you have to make the case, is that the people who can make a better case probably get their money, and the people who are not so swift on the ability to make the case
or don't have an advocate,
right?
You know, don't have an advocate,
a lobbyist,
right?
Yeah, and they'll get a couple of cracks at it too. I mean, the Senate's going to come out with their budget, I believe, in May. The House brings theirs out too, and because it'll play out over a several month process, we'll all be able to see the revenue numbers and how much money is available in the next couple of months. So what the governor proposes just kicks off the process, and which ends at the start of the fiscal year in the summer. I think what the governor has done is really maybe not subtle, but he's really made the budget more open. And let people, you know, go in there and see it in a rather uncomplicated way, which I think for the average citizen is a good thing.
This is being attributed to the new guy, Glenn Shore, the new budget chief, that this is a process that he wanted, and that, you know, so it's sort of new under his leadership. Is that your understanding, Jim?
I mean, I think the governor, when he first came into office, he wanted to make the budget more simple and make it clearer to the average voter and citizen. But I think it also shows that that they're always willing to innovate, and they're always willing to kind of try new things. And you know, if it doesn't work, if enough people complain, if enough constituencies complain, I'm sure there are minimal to change.
Well, what impresses me about the governor's initiative, having made, I hope, only modest fun of it, is, look, Deval is approaching the end of his term. The fact that he is still intellectually fully engaged and is still working hard for the best interests of Massachusetts residents is really a pretty remarkable thing.
I think he might have actually been in the governor's office more days than governors before him.
Oh,
I mean,
I don't
state,
know if that's saying much.
I know. I think that if at the end, if we tallied up how many days he was actually in the state, it's going to be a high number.
I note that, again, because we're doing under the radar here, that in your piece it says the changes, unless we had discussed them here, most people wouldn't even probably get for a while, that this is a big change, and that when he delivers his fiscal year 2014 proposal on January 23rd, this will be a part of it. And that may be the first time where people go, oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
So this is different. I like this piece that you did, going back to you, Peter Katsas, because it's part and parcel of sort of the new Phoenix, if you will.
Yeah.
It's a very long piece, very interesting, about Jamie Bissonette, who's a celebrity chef in Boston. Now, on its face, you could ask, why are you bringing that up? Because why is it under the radar? Because celebrity chefdom in Boston is now an economic driver. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are finally on the planet with some of these chefs that whose names are known. And this guy was a 2011 Food and Wine People Best Chef. And so to follow him around makes perfect sense. It was really a pretty interesting piece.
Runner-up for a James Beard Award. He's a wild guy. I mean, he's a straight edge, that for people who don't know, you know, hardcore rock and roll guy. That means, you know, someone into really hard music, but who himself didn't drink or smoke. And our reporter, Cassandra Landry, who may have the single best job in Boston, who writes about food for us, went to Hong Kong with him at his invitation, said, hey, come on, let's go over, and we're going to be eating food. And the food they eat sounds delicious. Sounds pretty weird to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But the story begins with them eating tripe, which is in intestines, being snipped with
a
scissors.
Of a cow.
Although there is pork tripe, too.
Yeah.
Which is, I prefer beef. And this is, you talk about omnivores, someone who will eat everything. But
he is.
It's a it's a fascinating read. First of all, the diversity of food in Hong Kong.
His response to it is so interesting.
He knows so much about it. But Boston is now a major culinary city. It's an economic engine that drives the area.
I mean, you know, the number of celebrity chefs we have in the South End, just on Tremont Street alone, is phenomenal. And I think that we can't underestimate the effect that shows like Top Chef have had.
Where
our very own
I'm a fan.
You know, your very own Bostonian chefs are in there competing on the high level and on Gordon Ramsay's show, which folks from the South End have competed on. That they have been able to take food which smells and tastes, put it on TV, and we totally get it. So it's a great time for Boston, especially in the chef world.
We should say that his restaurants that are known internationally are Toro and Kappa
in the South End.
And how do we know they're known internationally? He goes into a restaurant there, and people are like, "Whoa!"
He goes into I forget the name of the restaurant, but it is the least expensive one-star Michelin restaurant in the world. And people recognize them. There are pictures of chefs up on the wall.
And American chefs. And this just little tiny place in Asia. I mean, it is really amazing.
Even I'm cooking now. I just want to say, this whole wave of restaurants and chefs, I've actually started to cook. And I'm cooking. See, I have a burn. Right there.
Are you sure you're not talking about defrosting?
No, I'm cooking.
Again, have you been to Toro or Kappa?
I haven't. I do frequent the South End quite a bit. I was at Kitchen recently and a couple of the others, but it's definitely going to go on my list.
All right. Did you know about Jamie Bissonette before?
I did not. And it's shameful. My girlfriend works in restaurants, so I should. That's
shame on you.
Shame.
You really don't get it. Well, Cassandra Landry, we are envious of you, though. I have to say you have to be a little brave to follow him with some of the stuff that he said.
Yeah, was it the caterpillar lava that
turned
you off?
I want to open up a bug restaurant.
Okay.
An insect restaurant. All anybody right. in?
No.
I like grasshoppers.
Yeah,
they're good.
Yeah, yeah.
They're crunchy.
Come on,
okay,
Callie.
Obviously you people are on Friday. You've lost your mind. I appreciate all of your conversation here today. But we're not going to end on bugs.
All right.
Just want to point out that the High Five Pizza, as you wrote about in the Dorchester Reporter, again, was shut down, but it's coming back.
It is indeed. the managing editor, Bill Forey, he's been covering the story. It's gotten a tremendous response. I think we got 10,000 hits in 8 hours once we posted the story.
Yep. Wow.
So it's and Facebook just went berserk over it. This was on Tuesday, but he texted me shortly before I came here and said they're back up. They've got a payment plan with the State Department of Revenue.
They hadn't paid back taxes, but that's all being worked out.
It is.
I love the fact that people were complaining on the Originally from Dorchester website.
Well, of course they would be, right, Ken?
Can't help themselves.
Only the local angle.
Only the local language. All right. Well, thank you all for helping me go over the stories that went under the radar this week, the local stories. I've been speaking with Peter Katsas, executive editor of Boston Phoenix, Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News, and Gin Dumptious, news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Enjoy the weekend.